We're good. All right. let's look at Joel, Habakkuk, and Obadiah, prophets of despair. And the answer is not exactly. There's a little bit of despair, but ultimately they come out on the good side. But first, we want to review a little bit of M, N, and Z. Remember who these guys are? Micah, Nahum, and Zephaniah. And Micah, what we're going to look at was why the world secretly dreams about the leadership that only Jesus can give. And probably the best testimony to that is, in fact, that statue in front of the UN building. And it represents a longing for conditions that only Messiah can bring. I just think it's pretty ironic that that everybody wants that, and that's kind of a symbol that focuses a lot of what the UN is about. And yet no one would ever acknowledge, of course, that Jesus is the only one who can do that. But that's what Micah is about. Micah is about that world leader who's going to be born in Bethlehem will come and do. Nahum answered the question what it means to really trust God when other people treat you badly. And the answer was, when I want good for those who hurt me, I'm overcoming evil with good. So when you find your prayer life moving to that dynamic of God, she has hurt me or he has hurt me, but I really ask you to do good things to them today, you'll know that you are overcoming evil with good. Finally, why also such a wicked word? Zephaniah told us that it's not if you're hot or cold, but if you're lukewarm, that God's pretty disgusted. Because syncretism is the error of mixing truth and error, worshiping Yahweh and also Molech, putting those things together. The very best way to ruin truth is not to simply teach error, but to mix error with it. Nobody ever believes something that's totally false. People believe things that are just a little bit false. And that was the message of Zephaniah. So today, we want to look, first of all, at Joel, who gives us another example of how God is the relentless pursuer. Just doesn't give up. Habakkuk is very unique because we're going to listen in on a private conversation with God. All the other prophets are simply sermons or prophecies or messages to people, but this one is a private conversation just between the prophet and God. And finally, Obadiah. Why Obadiah delivered such a timely message. Certainly not a new one, but the time was really, really critical. So let's begin with a little historical background and put these people in their place. We've taken a look at Micah, Nahum, and Zephaniah last time, and between the exiles, between the two exiles, the northern ten tribes and southern two, is where Joel, Habakkuk, and Obadiah will fit. 630 is a pretty specific time period, but it's a critical turning point, and Joel and Habakkuk speak then. Obadiah actually comes after the exile, or immediately on the heels of the siege and what happened right after, and that time frame is very, very critical. So let's look at Joel first, and then move on to Habakkuk. The historical background to Joel is, in fact, this. It has to start at least here. And if you turn to page 107, you see that picture. What you're looking at there is an olive tree in Israel. And an olive tree in Israel is not just a place for shade or even a place to get olives, though you do that. It is a really important tree, simply because, not just of the olives, but because of the oil which comes from it. And use the oil for at least two really important things. Number one, for cooking. Number two, for lighting your house. So it's a really important one. And what you're looking at here is, no kidding, no fooling, 15 minutes before and 15 minutes after or so, a locust plague has come through. And I don't know about you, but I've never seen a plague like that. I've sometimes heard locusts that were sort of annoying, but that's about all locusts ever do to me. You know, just annoy me if they get noisy, but I've never seen this kind of thing. But you got to admit that this tree looks like it went from summer to winter, doesn't it, in 15 minutes? And it's not just the leaves, it's the fruit that's gone too. In fact, do you notice all that's gone in the right-hand picture? Even the guy and his little dog. You know, these are mean locusts when they come through. Carnivorous critters. But seriously, as you and I look at that, it still probably doesn't, you know, grab you or touch you or you know, fill your heart with fear. Because even if that did happen to the U.S., all you and I would do is go down to the grocery store and pick up some canned goods and, you know, we'd be just fine. But for these people, what this means is that you're going to get really hungry. And what it means is you have little kids, the little ones or the weaker ones, the older ones and the little ones are going to die. And it's like saying, hurricane to somebody who lives in New Orleans, you know, or saying earthquake to somebody who lives in California. If you've experienced a disaster like that, this is something that just takes you back and you go, oh man, what's going on here? Now, that's the historical background. A locust plague has just come through during Joel's time, and people are always asking, like they do in a huge natural disaster, why in the world did this happen? And so what Joel does as he comes along here, you can imagine, is he says, I'll tell you why, because Deuteronomy says so. Goes all the way back to Deuteronomy 28, which is just a verse 15, which is just a general statement. It should come to pass, if you don't obey the voice of the Lord, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. And I don't know if you've read it carefully or remember, but as you move down through Deuteronomy 28, sure enough, one of the curses mentioned is, locusts shall consume all your trees and the produce of your land. So the very first thing he does, which is Joel chapter 1, is he kind of preaches from this text and says, listen, this is a wake-up call. God wants you to wake up. This is not just a freak accident of nature. This is God trying to get your attention. So that is the essence of Joel chapter 1. But as the book moves on, it gets worse, because what he says is, listen, if you don't get it here, then something worse is going to happen. And as you read down through Deuteronomy 28, you read, the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle flies, a nation whose language you will not understand. And sure enough, this is the essence of Joel chapter 2. And what he says is, if you don't listen and change your ways, then the curses from Deuteronomy 28 will keep increasing, will get worse, and in fact, God will bring the Babylonians against you. Now, as you read through chapter 2, you may, you know, I trust that you've already read it, you may or may not have picked this up. Chapter 2 kind of looks like a big, massive, bigger plague coming on, because he speaks about the Babylonians as though they are big bugs. You know, I mean, kind of casts the Babylonians in chapter 2 in terms of the locust plague from chapter 1. So he talks about coming and eating everything that's green, just like the locusts do, which is really what the Babylonians are going to do too. So it's kind of like, hey, you know, I'll wake you up with the hit on the side, and then if not, hit on the head. Remember, we did this routine back in Deuteronomy 28, didn't we? And I think we used the book bag even. Yeah, yeah.
You smashed me with it.
I smashed you. Want to do it again? No, you don't want to. I want to do it to you again. But you get the idea here from Joel chapter 2. Or maybe we could, you know, use the... you guys ever had one of those alarm clocks that starts out quiet and gets worse and worse and worse? And if you wake up at the beginning, that's fine. If you don't, then it really gets annoying. And if you still don't wake up, then your roommate comes and hits you in the head and says, would you please turn that thing off? And that's what's going on here. If you don't get it from this and turn and change your ways, then you will get chapter 2. So in this book, Joel coins a phrase, Day of the Lord, which becomes very important for us for the rest of the Bible. The rest of the prophets use this term, and in fact, even the New Testament writers use this term. Paul uses this term in Thessalonians. John uses this term in the book of Revelation. A Day of the Lord is a day or time when God intervenes in history. This is God's day, like you've heard the phrase, you know, you've had your day, but God's going to have his day, or something like that. And this is when God has his day, when he intervenes in history in a really decisive way, in a way that's out of the ordinary. And he can come for one of two purposes, that is to judge negatively or deliver positively his people. And a day of the Lord can be a good thing or bad thing, depending upon how Israel has been behaving, or depending upon who he's coming for. So, godly people in the New Testament look forward to the day of the Lord. Ungodly do not, or should not, look forward to it, because it could be judgment or deliverance. So in this book, there are at least three different days of the Lord given. The first one has to do with the past, and that is, in fact, the locust plague, chapter 1. He says, this was a day of the Lord. God was the one who was behind this. He did it, and if you don't listen up, then there will be another destruction coming in the future, which will be worse. Now, he doesn't label it as the 586 destruction. I just labeled that so you know what he's talking about. But he's talking about when Babylon comes and carries them all away. So, if you learn from the bugs, you won't have to put up with the Babylonians. And then this book goes on even further to talk about tribulation times, the ultimate day of the Lord. The stars will fall from the sky and the moon will be turned to blood. And your young men will prophesy and people will see visions and dream dreams. So as we take a look at this book, you can see the threefold repetition, the mountains, as we've seen before. Chapter 1, the bugs came. Literal, no kidding around, insect bugs. Chapter 2, they might look like bugs in the text, but they are really Babylonians, okay? Soldiers who are coming by, dressed in green, I suppose. And if you got bugs in Babylon, then you have to have something that starts with B. Boom. All right. Tribulation period. All of those are days of the Lord that Joel talks about. And as you zoom out again and you look at the big picture, you got to say to yourself, what does this teach me about God? And this is not just about bugs and soldiers and stuff like that. What this is saying about God is that God just isn't giving up. He is the relentless pursuer. He's coming after you. If there is a time in your life, if you're going through it now or you've been through it in the past, or if not, you will go through it in the future, when you will say, you know, I've just sinned enough here that God probably doesn't care. And so you fail to go to God, and so your relationship with Him breaks down. And what Joel says is, listen, God is not in heaven saying, I'm so disgusted with you that I don't even really want to hear you coming. What he's saying is, man, I just wish you'd get past the sin and come back to me. He is the relentless pursuer who doesn't want to give up and will go to any length, whether it's bugs or Babylonians or boom, to get his people back to him. And in the big picture of this book, it is actually ultimately the boom. It is actually the tribulation, which will be the final thing which brings Israel back to him. And it is only when Israel is flat on her back that she will look up and finally say that which she did not say when Jesus came, right? Then we will have this man to rule over us. And blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So God wins. Good idea not to get in a battle with him because he always wins. I think that's all I want to tell you about Joel. Jake?
Yeah. Wouldn't hesitate to wipe them off the face of the earth and open them up, the ground up and swallow them whole. And now when his children sin, you don't see this kind of action yet. We claim, or we know actually, that he didn't change from then till now.
Right.
So why do you see it then, but you don't see it much now?
Two answers to that. Number one, it's a good question. That's not my answer, but just an observation. Good question. The second is, how do you know you don't see this today? I mean, how do you know you don't see this in a person's individual life, you know? I think sometimes we get so numb we don't recognize the actions of God working in our lives. But I'm confident that God still does work. And some people, you know, if we took some time here, I think some people could say, I can tell you when God has decisively worked in my life and gotten my attention. The second answer to it probably is that there's a whole lot of patience going on with God. Romans chapter 4 or Romans chapter 2 says, don't you know that the kindness of God leads us to repentance? So God doesn't always use the book bag. You know, sometimes he's just kind to people. And I don't know if you've ever experienced that or not, too. So sometimes when I've done really stupid things and I say, God ought to smash me for this, and God blessed me instead. And sometimes the kindness and the patience and goodness of God has broken my heart worse than the boom has. And the third answer, I suppose, is you notice that there are valleys between those peaks, right? And so we find ourselves in a valley period, but that doesn't mean that God isn't going to again decisively act in a powerful way in a day of the Lord that's still yet future.
Would you say he was less patient in the Old Testament?
Would I say he's less patient?
Or exercised less patience in the Old Testament?
Well, I don't know if I would say he exercised less patience in the Old Testament, but I would say that his people were obviously immediately in front of him. He was working directly with Israel. Whereas today, he is not working as directly with us, you know, doesn't controlling the weather and that kind of stuff today. Yeah.
If you believe in covenant theology, how would you interpret the third day of the Lord? Would you take it literally as a tribulation, or would you say it's God just judging us?
If I believed in covenant theology, which I don't, but if I did, then I would look at things like the third chapter, and I would say, let's take all of the Israel and the physicalness out of it, and so it just has to do with God disciplining Christians today.
Why don't you interpret that as Israel?
Why do I interpret?
Why wouldn't you do that with Israel then, too? If you took the third day of the Lord not literally, why would you take the first two literally?
Well, if you mean, or ask me if I were a covenant theologian,
yeah.
I would have a hard time taking the third one spiritually when I took the first two physically, which is precisely the reason why I'm not a covenant theologian. Right? Which is why I believe, you know, if God has identified himself in the Old Testament as anything, it is, I am Yahweh, the God who keeps my promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yeah. All right, shall we go on? All right, let's talk about Habakkuk, which is a unique and sweet little book. And in some ways, it's a little bit like Jonah, not so much in the message, but at least in the structure. Remember, the point of Jonah comes in which chapter? You guys all remember this from last Wednesday? Comes in the very last one, right? Because that's the same place where the point comes on an arrow. Ha, 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 right? At the end, the punchline comes at the end. Same thing is true here. And in chapter 3 is where really the message of this book comes. Now, chapters 1 and 2 are important, if for no other reason than at least to get to chapter 3 to work us through that. But God has to work Habakkuk through this, a series of questions in his own mind. And I don't know, I should quit talking about it and just get into the text. So let's do that. Right? A prophet's private conversation with God. Here is the way we're going to start. Habakkuk is looking out at the state of Israel in his day, or specifically Judah in his day. And he says, God, why do you allow such sin to continue among your people? He's kind of ripped. You know, like some of us are at various times, we look out and we say, God, you know, your name is on these people's lips, but their hearts are far from you. Why don't you just act and do something about it? God, shape up the church, okay, and make these people as spiritual as I am. At least in your pride and hubris, sometimes we say that. And here's the way he says it. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you don't listen? I cry out violence, that is, among the people, but you don't save. Why do you make me look at injustice among the people of Judah? And why do you tolerate wrong? Why do you just let them get away with this stuff? Why don't you do something about it? Why don't you judge them and take care of it? And so God listens to his question, and his answer is, oh, I won't let it continue. I'll destroy Judah, which is a little bit more answer than Habakkuk is looking for. And here's what he says. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. Which is specifically, verse 6, I'm raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. Now, you and I look at that and think, well, duh, what's so unbelievable about that? I mean, we know God uses the Babylonians. Well, that's because we're looking in hindsight, okay? But if you were here in Habakkuk's day, here's what the landscape looks like, okay? Judah is over here where Judah always is. Assyria is up here, and Assyria is the only real threat there is. Babylon, I mean, the people from Babylon live over here, but they're not a threat. At 630 BC, they're still 50 years away from being any kind of a threat at all. Now, so that's why it's a little bit unbelievable that God would, in fact, use them. It's as if I said to you that 10 years from now, God is going to use a mighty nation to overwhelm the United States. If I said that to you and you had to guess who it was, who would you guess? Who? China, yeah, probably China or China, okay. And I say, no, that's not it. Actually, the nation's going to come and overwhelm us. It's going to really become a powerhouse in the next 10 years is Puerto Rico. That's it. They're the ones. They're going to come. You say, yeah, right. That's how people felt about Babylon here. And God says, no, seriously, I'm going to raise them up and they're going to destroy you. So when Habakkuk finds out that Babylon is the one that God is going to use, he looks and he says, are you sure? Are you sure you want to use these people? Right? And that's where we go next. Why will you use wicked Babylon to punish Judah? O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die, or God, don't let us die. And I think if Habakkuk were here, he would read it something like this. He would say, O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O Rock, you have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil, that is, to look on, to approve of evil. You can't condone this. And why would you look on these evil people and allow them to do this? You can't tolerate wrong. Why do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked, that is, Babylon, swallow up those more righteous than themselves, Judah? God, bad idea. Don't do this, okay? And God says, boy, Habakkuk, you know, you're right. You have a point. They are pretty wicked. So, here's my answer. I will also punish Babylon for her sin eventually. That is, after they have destroyed Judah. And so the rest of chapter 2 is condemnation of what will happen to Babylon. So at this point then, God has been conversing with Habakkuk. Habakkuk has been asking God to do things, and God does it, sort of. And we are then brought to the climax, and the climactic question is this. Are we finished as a nation? Now again, from hindsight, this is not a real burning, pressing question for us. I mean, we know that God does not give up. But when you're in his position, you got to wonder. God, you're bringing the Babylonians to come and to destroy us and to exile us. Does that mean the covenant is over? Does that mean we're gone? Are we finished? Are you giving up? And you'll notice that the answer in your notes 2b is by Habakkuk. That's why the capital letters are there, okay? This is the first time the question has been answered by someone other than God. And this is really significant. You got to ask yourself why. Well, even in here, sometimes you guys ask such good questions. Sometimes I say it, sometimes I think it, don't say it, but I say, you know, that is such a good question, I'm not going to answer it. If you ask a really, really good question, I sometimes won't answer it because I say, that is such an important, insightful question. What I really want is for you to answer it yourselves. I want you to own the answer. So I'm not going to answer it, you go figure it out. And that really is what's happening here. When Habakkuk looks at God and says, God, are we finished as a nation? God says, that is such a good question. That is a very good question. Habakkuk, that is so important, you figure it out. So Habakkuk has to think about the question and has to think about the answer. And he comes up with it. And the way he comes up with it is a studied review of God's work in the past in chapter 3. Now, watch what he does because it's going to be so geographically located that it's sometimes a little hard to figure out. It's going to be a little bit vague. But if you pay attention, there's some clues you can pick up and you can start to figure it out and then you'll be on your way. So watch and see if you can figure this out quicker than the 9 o'clock class did, okay? Always a little challenge anyway. God came from Teman, the Holy One, from Mount Paran, Selah. Say, I don't even know where those places are. How can you Selah that? Well, keep watching. His glory covered the heavens. His praise filled the earth. His splendor was like the sunrise. Rays flashed from his hand where his power was hidden. So you say, okay, I don't know where the places are. I don't know exactly what's going on here. But at least you can see that Habakkuk is looking back on some time in the past when God has evidently shown himself powerful on Israel's behalf, right? Where his power was hidden, he kind of flashed it, and he showed himself really powerful. I don't know when it was, but sometime God has done some miraculous work on Israel's behalf. So when would this be? Well, keep watching. Plague went before him, and pestilence followed his steps. So that's a pretty specific clue. What do you think he's thinking about? 10 plagues, He stood and he shook the earth. He looked and he made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled. That is, the ancient governments like Egypt crumbled. The age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. As the text says, were you angry with the rivers, O Lord? Was your wrath angry against the streams? Now, when would some outsider, it's a rhetorical question, of course, but when would some outsider look at what God had done and said, God really beat up on those rivers. Was he angry with the rivers? When did God beat up on rivers?
When they crossed the Jordan.
When they crossed the Jordan is one good example. And there's another one that's really good too.
Nile.
The Nile, yeah, right. So was God angry with the Jordan when he cut it in two violently? Was he angry with the Nile when he turned it to blood? And the answer, of course, is no, I wasn't angry with the rivers, but what was he doing? He was showing lots of power to do what? What was he doing both of those times? He was demonstrating that they were false gods, true, in Egypt, and he was against Baal as well. But he was not only overcoming those other gods negatively, but he was positively doing something, which was he was fulfilling his promises to his people, wasn't he? He's taking them out of Egypt and putting them into the land. Right. So he was showing himself powerful in order to keep his promises to Israel. In fact, it gets even more specific here. Sun and moon stood still in the heavens. Now, when does that have to be? It's got to be a reference to Joshua, doesn't it? When the sun and the moon stood still. You came out to deliver your people, to save your anointed one. You crushed the leader of the land of wickedness. Probably a reference to Pharaoh, stripping him from head to foot. Taking away his glory, taking away his 600 chariots, his military power, taking away his son, the next god to be in Egypt. And so what he's talking about here is God showed himself really powerful in giving birth to this nation. in bringing this nation out of Egypt, in bringing this nation into the land, in securing this nation in the land. And that's kind of the basis for his thinking here. God really showed himself powerful. He used lots of miracles. Would he have gone to all that effort in the beginning to simply give up on it now? So he moves on to this. You trample the sea with your horses, churning the great waters, probably a reference to the Red Sea. And then he says, I heard and my heart pounded, my lips quivered at the sound, decay crept in my bones, and my legs trembled. Now he's talking here about the first chapter and second chapter. When I heard the news that Babylon was coming, it made me sick to my stomach. Right? I'm really sick that Babylon is coming, yet, because of what I have just remembered about God's work, I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us because, and here he uses some of the most beautiful poetry of all the Old Testament. I hope you appreciate this and enjoy this. Though the fig tree does not bud and there are no grapes in the vines, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, even though the outlook is really, really bad, even though Babylon is coming, are we finished as a nation? And the answer is, I will rejoice in the Lord. I'll be joyful in God my Savior. I'll rejoice in Yahweh. Why? Because the God who went to all this work to bring us this far surely will not give up on us now. And I'm sure God is in heaven when Habakkuk says this and says, good answer. Good answer. That's the right answer. And in fact, Habakkuk comes along and says, the sovereign Yahweh is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer that is sure-footed and confident. He enables me to go on the heights. Why? I can take the tough times because I know good times are coming. I can take the hard times because I know that I'm ultimately in the hands of a God who wouldn't have gone to all this trouble just to leave me here. I mean, it's certainly true in a macro theological sense with the nation of Israel. But it's also true in a very personal sense for us. Because the same things are said to us in the New Testament. Being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. It's exactly what Paul's saying here. God has gone to this work in your life to bring you to this point. He's not going to give up on you now. And I know it's always tempting to feel that way. I don't know if you guys feel that way, but I do. I look and I think, man, I'm such a loser. I should be so much further ahead in the spiritual life than where I am now. I am so slow. I'm such a slow learner. And every time I take two steps forward, I seem to take one back. God, what is wrong with me? I should be such a better husband. I should be such a better dad. I should be such a better teacher. Do you just want to give up on me? And it's like God says, you know, that is a really good question. Why don't you answer that? And Habakkuk does that. Is the God who brought us this far going to give up on you now? I don't think he would have wasted that energy to do that if he were just going to give up now. So Habakkuk is a pretty sweet little book, I think. One that is very, very encouraging, not just to my theology about Israel, but to me personally about God bringing me to completion and making me an Abraham kind of a person someday. Which brings me to Obadiah. Isn't it a great name? Does anybody here vow to name your firstborn son Obadiah? I give extra credit for it if you do. I had a guy who took me up on it once. His name was Joe Canobly. Joe said, as long as I can name his middle name Juan, I'll do that. Figured he'd have Obi-Wan Canobly. Yeah, he said it. And I'll give him extra credit too if his wife will agree. But he needs to find a wife first. All right. With Obadiah, it's a neat little book. It's obviously a very little book, for sure. And as I said at the beginning, it is not the message which is so unique, but it is the timing which makes this thing so, so worthy of putting in the Scripture and keeping for us. And if I can just give you a little illustration from my own life, I would go back many years ago to one of the most depressing days of my life. And it was almost my birthday in 1985 because I'd been teaching for a while in upstate New York and determined that we needed some more education, needed to get a doctoral degree. So my wife and I decided to sell everything we had, sell the house, and to put everything we had in a truck and move from upstate New York, Scroon Lake, down to Dallas, Texas to do doctoral work. So we did that and kind of stepped out by faith, and my wife and our two kids at the time left. And we worked all day on a Saturday trying to get everything packed up into this 22-foot Ryder truck, and we did. Totally exhausted by the time we did, but we were so excited that we decided to take off and leave. Now, my wife was going to fly down, and she did fly down with two kids a couple days later, but my buddy Dave and I had decided to drive the truck, obviously, and we should have stayed there that night and rested, but we were too stupid and young, and so we just took off. Now, what I didn't tell you was that there had already been 18 inches of snow that day, right? It was just horrible. And so we got about 2 hours down the road, and finally the day caught up with us, and we were totally exhausted, so we pulled over to rest. And so since my buddy Dave is helping me out, I let him have the bench seat. He sleeps there, and I sleep down on the floor where this transmission stick is, you know, sticking my belly, and I can't ever get comfortable. As cold as can be, you know, we're just shivering, and so you can't sleep because it's too cold, but you can't drive because you're too sleepy, and it's just miserable, if you know what I'm talking about. And we just do this all night long. We're just completely exhausted. And the snow follows us all the way from New York in this line all the way down to Texas. And there are a lot of times when you can't even see the lines in the road because the snow is so heavy. And it really is miserable because I thought, well, you know, maybe I can talk to my buddy for these 3 days, 3 day trip down there. But I got so sick, my voice doesn't work. I can't talk at all. And the very worst part of it was that in order to get accepted in this program, you don't only have to know Greek and Hebrew, but German and French, and so they give you an entrance exam in German when you get there. So I had, you know, 3 years in high school, but I hadn't messed with it much since that time, so I figured, okay, for 3 months before December, I will study this. Well, like any good student, I didn't, right? You know, why study ahead of time when you can wait to the last minute? So I figured, okay, you know, on the trip down there, I'll really study hard and I'll bone up on it. Like, yeah, 3 years of French is going to come back in like one night. But, you know, you're a student, so that's what you figure will happen. And, you know, I'm so miserable. I don't want to do this. And it's dark in the cab and I can't turn a light on. And during the day, I just don't want to. And I say to myself, I'm going to get down there. I'm going to flunk this exam and they're going to send me back home. And this is just so stupid. So we finally get down there. I'm just miserable. And we get down to Dallas and the sun is shining in the morning. I think, oh, this is so great. It's down here. It's the south. It's warm. And I jump out of the truck and I hit some ice and I fall down and bust my elbow. And I think, this is not supposed to work like this. It's not supposed to be cold down here. And we drive into this apartment complex where we'd rented this place, had never seen it before. And on the way in, there's this little hill on the side, and there's a couple little boys, about 7 or 8, and they got this other little kid down on the ground. They're just beating the tar out of this kid. I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't want to bring my 4-year-old, my 2-year-old down here. And so the apartment person lets us in, and they turn on the lights, and it's like Roach Motel inside. All these little bugs look and just scurry, get out of the way. You know, it's like, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into? And I said to the lady, I said, I'm sorry, you know, we don't want to stay here. And I didn't know where we were going to stay. And I only knew one guy in Dallas. And this guy said, you can stay at our house. Now, the trouble was, his house wasn't big enough. We couldn't stay in his house, so we stayed in his garage. Right? So my buddy Dave flies back. My wife and two kids arrive, pick him up at the airport, and I take him home to our new garage. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, there's just something in the heart of a dad and a father that wants to provide for his family, and I'm thinking, I have just so completely messed up. You know, I'm sick, I'm going to fail this exam, they're going to send me back home and say, you don't belong here. And we're sitting with all of our belongings in a truck and living in a garage, and I'm just thinking, I am the biggest loser on the face of the earth. And I looked at my wife and said, maybe we should just, you know, get in the truck and drive back to New York. And she said, no. She said, I want to be here. I said, why? She said, I love you. And I know this sounds silly, but I looked at her and I said, are you sure? Because I didn't feel very lovable. She said, no, I really love you. And she said, and what's more, we can do this. And again, I know this sounds silly, but I looked at her and I said, really? And she said, yeah, you can do this. I said, you're not just saying this? She said, no, you can do this. And even to this day, one of my wife's biggest failings is she just has too much confidence in me. But she did. She said that, I love you and you can do this, because I'm telling you what, I know this sounds silly now because everything just worked out so marvelously well. And those next 2 years were two of the best years of our lives in every way, in family way and in vocational way and in studying. It just turned out great. But I'm telling you, at that point, I did not feel that way. And when she said, I love you and I believe in you, she says that to me nearly every day of our existence. But I will never forget the time she said it there, because I just felt so bad and the timing was so, so critical. And what makes Obadiah so important here is not that it's a very new message, but it's the timing. Let me explain to you why in Israel's life, this was the lowest day of their collective life, all right? It was the lowest day because the map looks like this. And we have just finished the siege in Jerusalem. Siege is a very, very ugly, inhuman time. They had been basically starved out so that people had eaten, had become cannibals. And the very few who did survive the Babylonian siege escaped and headed south after the walls were torn down. And that's when the people from Edom, the Edomites, against which Obadiah is written, decided to come out and to meet them. Now, you know, just the most basic sort of morality or the most basic sort of decency would have been, you poor people, you wretched, miserable survivors. You're our enemies, but we will try to help you, right? Edom doesn't do that. Edom takes what little they have and kills many of them and takes advantage of them. So it's like, you know, the ultimate case of adding insult to injury here. Now, what God does then is he brings this little book of Obadiah, which is a message of judgment against Edom. And here's what it looks like. Your warriors, O T-man, will be terrified. And everyone in Esau's mountains will be cut down. Why? Because the violence against your brother Jacob, you'll be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. On the day you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You should not march to the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor look down on them in their calamity, in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble. The day of the Lord is near for all nations, and as you have done, it will be done to you, and your deeds will return upon your own head. Now, let's just look at that last verse, okay? As you have done, it will be done to you. How would the Israelites have heard this message against the Edomites? When God says to the Edomites, as you've done, it'll be done to you, your deeds will return upon your own head, how would they have heard that? What would have been going through their minds when they heard that? That sounds like what to the Israelites? God's doing what to the Edomites? God's cursing them. Why? Because they have cursed Israel. Right? Sounds a whole lot like Genesis chapter 12. What he's saying is, I'm still blessing those who bless you. I'm cursing those who curse you. Now, why is that message so important? And again, it's not like you haven't heard it before. You've heard it a lot, right? But the timing is so important because what has just happened to us is this. We've seen all semester long this left-hand side of the chart and the one-sided unconditional promises being given. But we've also seen this idea of the Mosaic Covenant in the book of Deuteronomy. Now, what has just happened here in Obadiah? What has just happened is we have just gotten to the end of Deuteronomy 28, right? And the very last verse, verse 68, when all these curses have come upon you and I disperse you, I'm going to exile you and send you away into captivity, and that's going to be the end of this covenant. This covenant will be broken. It will be gone, right? So at this point, the people are saying, God, is the covenant over? Is our relationship with you gone? Because the ultimate curse of Deuteronomy 28 has been poured out on us. And what Obadiah comes along and says is this, you know what? That right-hand side might be gone, right? It's gone. But you know what? This is still here. Genesis chapter 12 is still here. And even though this relationship as described by Deuteronomy is gone and the old covenant is over now, you still got this relationship with God through the promises. Or to state it specifically or directly, Obadiah says, I'm still cursing those who curse you. Still. Right? The Mosaic covenant may be broken, But the promises to Abraham will never be forgotten. So that what you really have here is, again, not a new message, but one which, when spoken on this day about these enemies, kind of has Genesis 12 stamped all over it. God is saying here by this little message of Obadiah, you know what, I still love you. And I'm sure that Israel's saying, really? God's saying, yeah, I still believe in you. And Israel's saying, are you sure? And God says, yeah, pretty sure. Pretty sure. In fact, real sure. So it's only when those messages, it's only in a time of tragedy or difficulty that those messages of real love and faithfulness come through as clearly as they do here. So the only appropriate way to finish this, the only appropriate word to finish this would be, yeah, I think this is, you have to Selah this one. So have a great day, everybody. See you on Wednesday.